Chapter 2. The Disappearance of the Original. The Second Decline of the Avant-Garde. The police discovered untold treasures in a furniture storage facility in Wiesbaden in 2013. Hundreds of futurist paintings by Russian modernists from the first decades of the 20th century. What was unbelievable about the discovery was the sheer size of it. More masterworks from this important era, revolutionary for the history of art, than in most museums inside or outside Russia. Paintings in the style of Malevich, Yovlensky, Rodchinka, Lisitsky, Gencharova, Popova, and Kandinsky. Such an enormous trove of art would have to be worth hundreds of millions of euros, if not a billion, on the art market. But the collection was stored by its owner like used furniture, without security or climate control, frame jammed against frame. The search and seizure at the furniture warehouse on June 12, 2013, was part of an international offensive against the trade in counterfeit works of art. Over the course of 2 days, more than 100 officers from the Bundeskriminalamt, or BKA, the German Federal Criminal Police Office, searched 28 apartments, galleries, storerooms, and businesses, not just in Wiesbaden, but also in Mainz, Stuttgart, Munich, Hamburg, Cologne, and other German cities. Other raids took place in Switzerland. Accounts were frozen. The police in Israel held 8 suspects in custody for a short while. The target of the operation was a global network of alleged counterfeiters and fences, supported by art experts who provided the necessary authentications. The BKA had been hot on the trail of the alleged counterfeiting ring for months. The investigation was touched off by information from the Israeli National Fraud Investigations Unit of the Israeli police. They believed that they had discovered counterfeiters from Russia who did business by way of Israel as a connection to Germany, among other countries. In Wiesbaden, 2 of the lead suspects were taken into custody for questioning about commercial fraud: a 67-year-old Israeli named Itzhak Z, and a younger man who was born in Mainz, who will be referred to here as Mohammed W. Itzhak Z would remain in custody for 2 years, Mohammed W for 3, while the investigation continued. Itzhak Z and Mohammed W had already been convicted by an Italian court in February 2013, a few months before their arrest in Germany, for a transaction involving a counterfeit Kandinsky painting. The penalty of 1 year probation and fines was commensurate with the law, but apparently did not stop their activities. In February 2015, a trial began that would become one of the longest in the Wiesbaden court. Finally, after 3 years, a total of 150 days of proceedings in the courtroom, both men were convicted and sentenced. By then, many of the transactions involving the fake pictures were beyond the statute of limitations. Although the number of offenses had exploded with the seizure of the 1,500 fakes, the charges were reduced. The prosecutor had only sought an indictment in the 19 cases where proof of fraud seemed most achievable. Why counterfeiters are drawn to Russian modernism? The judgment, which runs to more than 100 pages, reads like a primer on how counterfeiting infects the market for the art of Russian modernism. The judges describe the beginnings of how modernism flowed into Russian art. The success of painters such as Malevich under Lenin, and the founding in the Soviet Union in 1921 of a museum for suprematist and constructivist artists. And they report on the downfall of the avant-garde after Stalin took power in 1922, how the dictator effectively banned abstract art and singled out socialist realism as the one true art of the state. After Stalin's ban of the avant-garde, such work was removed from collections in Soviet museums. Many works were destroyed or disappeared forever. Others were taken into private collections, warehoused in attics and secret storerooms, and this became decades later the stuff of countless legends related to their rediscovery. This art was rediscovered first and foremost by George Kostakis, the son of a Greek commercial family who was born in Moscow in 1913. He worked in Russia in various embassies and consulates and privately collected pictures by Vasily Kandinsky and Lubov Popova. At some point, he became known as a good customer for pictures from this forgotten era in art at the start of the Soviet Union. Whoever still had something came to him, and Kostakis succeeded in putting together a big collection of several thousand artworks. When he moved to Greece in 1977, as part of a deal with the Soviet state, he gave the majority of his collection to the state-owned Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow. In exchange, he got to export and take with him about 1,200 works of art. A few years after Kostakis' death in 1990, the Greek government bought this important art collection. Today it is housed in the Museum for Modern Art in Thessaloniki. Kostakis was the pioneer in the rediscovery of constructivism, though in the West, the collectors and museum founders Peter and Irina Ludwig also proved to be ready buyers. There are many stories told about how these two, originally in the business of chocolate manufacturing, became collectors and obtained works from the then still communist Soviet Union in the 1970s and 1980s. There are rumors of economic support and food shipments the Ludwigs arranged in exchange for art. And there are witnesses from that time who speak of high-ranking collaborators in the Russian embassy in Bonn, who are alleged to have smuggled artworks out of the Soviet Union in diplomatic pouches. Galleries in the Federal Republic of Germany then served as the official sellers. Today, these Russian works can be seen in the 26 museums, from Cologne to Budapest, that have been underwritten by the Ludwig Foundation. A scholarly work on the provenance of these artworks has been in the making for many years now. An exhibition at the Museum Ludwig, Cologne, in 2020, and the accompanying catalog made clear, however, that the Ludwigs were also sold some fakes, as were many other collectors and museums in Berlin, London, and elsewhere. With the opening up of the Soviet Union in the mid-1980s during the perestroika period, more and more works reached the West and sold at ever higher prices. This, in turn, and here most art historians agree, was a wake-up call to counterfeiters in the countries formerly belonging to the USSR and internationally. What Stalin condemned had turned into lucrative merchandise, and the decades of political upheaval in the Soviet Union made it easy to invent the provenance. The judgment of the Wiesbaden court explained how counterfeiters worked. Trained painters or restorers sourced the canvas and paints that existed during the lifetime of the artist. From these, works are made in the style of the desired artist by appropriating parts of known originals and assembling them into a new composition, a pastiche. Or the counterfeiters simply copy known works, sometimes in a new medium. A sketch turns into a painting, or a drawing becomes a watercolor. Then the pictures are artificially aged, dried in the oven, rubbed with dust from the attic, or worked on with tea. If the counterfeiter does the job right, the counterfeits look as if they survive for decades. The craquelure, the fine veins of cracking visible in paint, which usually appear only many years later, can be simulated during the painting process through the addition of certain chemicals, or induced by rolling and smashing the canvas and heating it in the oven. Next, an appropriate history must be invented for the provenance of the painting, a seemingly legitimate list of previous owners, exhibitions, and catalog entries, or a very good explanation for the gaps in the provenance, why this work, so long hidden, has now resurfaced. For the works of Russian modernism, it was easy to explain the disappearance and the sudden resurfacing. Without any documentation, exhibition history, or named owners, because of the chaos at the time of the Russian Revolution, the condemnation by Stalin, and the decline of old institutions amid the dissolution of the Soviet Union. An antiques hunter opens his gallery. Itzhak Z. testified during the trial in Wiesbaden and afterward how he had gathered his enormous collection, which he thought placed him in the same tradition as the great collector George Kostakis. Before the court, he called himself the savior of the Russian avant-garde. He said that he had not commissioned forgeries, but rather had assembled the collection over the course of 3 decades, partly through risky adventures. He testified further that, since the mid-1980s, he had been active as an antiques hunter in the Eastern Bloc, but was robbed and defrauded. He said that he cultivated contacts to artists' estates, and through them had uncovered secret repositories in the former republics of the Soviet Union. He claimed that some of the works were smuggled out of the country and covered up with a black overpainting so that at customs they were no longer recognizable. Later, the canvases were cleaned with a solvent, revealing the painting beneath. He testified that he had owned more than the 1,500 works that were seized, but many had been sold over the last 30 years. Several pictures were to be found in the Museum Ludwig in Cologne, which had acquired them through a French gallery. A former director of the museum maintained strong ties to the French gallery in Paris and with its branch in Israel, as a customer. Itzhak Z said he met Mohammed W. in the late 1990s at the flea market. At first, Mohammed W. bought watches for Z. Then he took over the negotiations for pictures. It started with just one painting, by the Russian artist Ivan Puni. But Mohammed W. called for professionalizing the operation. Thus, Itzhak Z., along with two business partners, founded the company SNZ Galleries in Wiesbaden in 2002, with Mohammed W. as chief executive officer. Later, one of the partners left the business, and Itzhak Z. took over his share. He also established an offshore company in Panama in 2005, Art Society Incorporated, through which many of his transactions with the pictures later flowed. The entity pops up in the Panama Papers, the files regarding the law firm Mossack Fonseca, which became famous for the establishment of letterbox companies in 2016. In the rooms of the Wiesbaden Gallery, although they were suitably decorated, there was neither the climate control nor the security that would be expected for old works such as these. The gallery received pictures from Z's collection through commercial package services like UPS, instead of specialized art courier services. They were rolled up and packed, scarcely insured, and designated at customs regularly as having a declared value of a few hundred euros. The pictures were then sent to the laboratory of Dr. Jaegers in Bornheim, near Cologne, where over time hundreds of works from this source were examined. Itzhak Z. had already worked with Erhard Jaegers before the founding of SNZ Galleries. Once, Z had even invited the chemist to Israel to examine a few pictures there. Jaegers usually took pigment samples and analyzed them to determine if they corresponded to the alleged age of the work. His laboratory rejected numerous pictures from Z on the basis of pigments in the paint that didn't belong to the period in which the work supposedly was made. But a large portion of the art sent to him withstood his testing process. According to the testimony of the chemist, between 30% and 70% of the paintings examined in his laboratory each year came from SNZ galleries. And still, for example, works supposedly by Kazimir Malevich that were worth 8 figures if genuine were rolled up and shipped by common carriers. Even in his affirmative opinions, Jaegers didn't state that the pictures were authentic. Rather, he opined that nothing in the samples he had taken and examined contradicted the possibility that the work was created at the point in time claimed by the seller. Experts in danger. The authentication of a painting requires, in addition to the examination of the material and technical aspects, an assessment from the art historical perspective, in which the provenance and style are tested. Many defrauders thus outfit their works with supplementary art historical expert opinions, which are supposed to prove their genuineness. In Russia, as well as in Germany, France, and England, there are numerous experts, very often art historians, who have specialized in the certification of Russian avant-garde work. Many of the pictures offered by SNZ galleries had such art historical certifications, not infrequently from the same experts. And quite a few of the buyers were plainly dazzled by these reports, although the reports usually emphasized that they were simply descriptions from the perspective of the history of art, which avoided any representation that could be used against them legally. Besides the compliant or fraudulent dealers, the core of the problem of Russian avant-garde art counterfeiting is the so-called experts. Some experts appear to be either so naive or so corrupt that they write authenticating opinions, even for rather fanciful forgeries. Others borrow the suspect works for exhibitions in the second or third-tier museums that they lead, thus ennobling the works and enhancing their credibility and value. Critical experts are pressured by defrauders with the help of lawyers and massive threats, such that they prefer not to opine that any work is fake. "I can't go to Moscow for my vacation," said one expert, who had exposed 100 forgeries in the summer of 2013. Another reported, also on condition of anonymity, that one day his car was demolished. When art becomes the object of speculation, then scholarly authentication turns into a business, and a dangerous one at that. How Dealers Finance an Advisory Board. Before they were sold or offered for sale, most of the artworks at SNZ galleries were examined by art historians with whom Z had already had good experiences. Many of them were connected to an organization that was founded in Paris in April 2007, the International Committee of Russian Modernism, which was recognized in 2008 as a non-profit organization, and in 2009 changed its name to International Chamber of Russian Modernism, INCORM. According to its bylaws, the organization is a union of art historians and scholarly experts who are united to support the Russian avant-garde. As explained in a written statement by its president, Patricia Rayling, the experts of INCORM are held to the highest ethical standards. The Code of Good Practice of the organization states that the members of INCORM are not permitted to give an opinion if there is a conflict of interest or a commercial connection. It first became clear during the investigation by BKA and the ensuing trial that the founding of INCORM could be traced back to the two accused gallery owners, Itzhak Z and Mohammed W, as well as a French citizen who was interested in art. The opening event of the foundation was funded, in essence, by SNZ Galleries. A co-worker from the Wiesbaden Gallery served as general secretary. The accused were clearly pursuing their own financial gain in setting up the foundation, the Wiesbaden court found. SNZ had created its own organization, whose members would certify the goods for sale, while giving itself the appearance of being especially virtuous. The continuation of these legal proceedings would reveal in particular just how compromised INCORM President Patricia Rayling was in carrying out this mission. Invented provenance. SNZ Galleries even tried to penetrate the higher circles of the international art market in the 2000s, but without success. According to a person associated with the gallery, pictures were offered to the leading international auction houses, such as Sotheby's, Christie's, and Bonhams, but they were rejected because of the lack of provenance. Still, some pictures landed at smaller auction houses in Germany, France, and Switzerland. Market experts were already astonished in 2007 by the boom in the Russian avant-garde. Auction houses in Munich and Stuttgart, which had previously not dealt in this area, were suddenly and almost simultaneously staging special auctions. Isolated works of the Russian avant-garde were also offered for sale at other auction houses in Munich, Hamburg, and Zurich. The sales at the auction house Nagel on April 26, 2007, stood out in particular. 56 works were offered at once by this Stuttgart firm in a special catalog. The provenance in the catalog suggests that the works were sold by a member of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to an Italian comrade around 1946, while in some cases a German private collection is listed as the source. Complete nonsense is what the independent art historian Konstantin Akinsha called that story in the German magazine Die Zeit. Foreigners were very strictly surveilled at that time in the Soviet Union. It would have been impossible to get this work, which Stalin had outlawed, out of the country. For the U.S. magazine Art News, Akinsha had researched and written about the alleged previous owners of the art. He found out that they didn't exist. And for several dozen of the works offered, he discovered the originals from which they had been copied in museums around the world. This didn't appear to have come to the attention of the experts cited in the Nagel catalog, who wrote their opinions in a matter of a few days in Paris and Berlin, or else they found it not worth mentioning in the catalog. It is clear regarding the painting Still Life with Lobster by Larionov that an expert is alleged to have examined it on a day when it had already been in storage at a facility belonging to the auction house for the previous 8 days. No evidence exists of a visit by the expert to the storage facility. SNZ received about 1.4 million euros for the auction of the work submitted, paid in several tranches, mostly in cash. The investigations found that in a work on paper allegedly by the artist Alexandra Exter, the hat of a woman was painted with an improper pigment. Orange 62 was first patented by the company Hoechst in 1960, so Exter, who died in 1949, couldn't have used it. Even before the material and technical examination, the Exter expert, André Nakhov, had judged the work to be a fake for stylistic reasons. Itzhak Z and Mohammed W were, however, not found guilty for this forgery, which Mohammed W had furbished with false provenance. It couldn't be proved that they knew it was a fake. Charges of fraud for the other pictures that Nagel sold at auction, for instance one with false provenance from an Italian baron, were barred by the statute of limitations. Similar sales of Russian art at a Munich auction house, which Konstantin Akinsha thought included many inauthentic paintings, didn't play a role in the trial in Wiesbaden. The end of SNZ Galleries. Originally, the complaint against the defendants, Itzhak Z and Mohammed W, had included the accusation that they had collaborated with a third person in a criminal gang, which increased the statute of limitations from 5 years to 10 years in a fraud case. But the third person was set free. The court didn't see a gang at work, and all cases of fraud older than 5 years were barred from prosecution. Still, two works on paper were a problem for the accused. A sketch of Color Dynamics, 1917-18, by Alexandra Exter, which allegedly had hung in a Paris gallery and in a private collection in Belgium, and Alexander Rodchenko's Watercolor for a Construction, 1919, which according to the invented provenance had been held in a Soviet museum and a private collection. Both works on paper were sold to a private collector who chanced upon them in the window of SNZ Galleries while strolling through the downtown pedestrian shopping district of Wiesbaden. The watercolor for a price of 43,500 euros, and the work by Exter for 29,000 euros. For the Rodchenko picture, the collector received a statement regarding its imaginary provenance, as well as an expert opinion from Patricia Rayling. On January 7, 2008, she had certified the authenticity of the work from an art historical perspective and confirmed the provenance. She referred in her declaration to positive technical analysis of the pigments and paper. Yet this work was among the few that Erhard Jagers had identified during his investigation as being counterfeit. The chemist had notified the chief executive officer of SNZ Galleries on December 4, 2007, that he had found thalassianine blue in a test of the picture. The painter would have been able to use this pigment at the earliest following its introduction in the mid-1930s, a good decade after the date of 1919 attached to this alleged Rodchenko construction. The picture by Exter was executed on paper that, according to expert opinion, was not yet produced at the time the picture was allegedly painted. Despite numerous sales, the business of SNZ Galleries didn't prosper as its founders had hoped. The storefront in the Wiesbaden shopping district was closed at the end of 2009. After the closing, the court found Mohammed W. still tried to dispose of the artworks from the fabulous warehouse at the behest of Itzhak Z. At this point, they worked with collectors and middlemen whose business practices sometimes sound beyond the pale. Cheap-looking catalogs were printed, with supposed provenance and citing certifications of authenticity by members of INCORM in order to facilitate sales from exhibitions in private homes. At the end of the 3-year trial, and after lengthy disputes among the prosecutors, defense attorneys, experts, and witnesses, 6 of the 19 works in the original complaint remained, and Itzhak Z and Mohammed W were found guilty. Judge Ingeborg Boimer-Courant detailed the reasoning in her opinion for an hour and a half on March 15, 2018, in the Wiesbaden State Court. The judge found that the charges of commercial fraud had been proven against the accused. Various pictures had been identified scientifically as fakes, and doubt created about their provenance. The accused had been aware of these facts and had nonetheless sold the works as originals. Therefore, the court sentenced Itzhak Z to 2 years and 8 months imprisonment. His co-defendant received a sentence of 3 years confinement. At the time of this writing, however, the judgment had not yet been enforced. Two paintings from Itzhak Z's collection were seized as instruments of crime, in addition to six-figure euro payments by both of the condemned. In a deal that reduced his sentence, Mohammed W. had apparently admitted, and it was proven by tapped telephone calls as well, that he had falsified the provenances. It remained unclear from the trial who had counterfeited the works themselves. The court did not pursue evidence that in this case, as in other cases of counterfeit art, the path led to Israel and Russia. Although he sat at the defense table, Itzhak Z. appeared not to hear the judge's opinion, or he simply ignored it. For, right in the courtroom, his British press representative distributed a prepared statement. "I am pleased that the accusations against me and my pictures have been proven groundless." The second response followed that evening by email. More than 1,800 works seized by the German authorities in 2013 had been accepted by the court as authentic. Moreover, it stated that the court had denied the existence of an international counterfeiting ring. In response to an inquiry, a spokeswoman for the Wiesbaden court wrote that the court had in no sense found 1,800 works to be genuine. The subject of the criminal process had been limited to 19 works. Nothing could be said regarding the authenticity of other works. An expert reported that many of the pictures were once more offered for sale in London in the fall of 2019. At the time of this writing, Itzhak Z's attorney hadn't responded to questions concerning the whereabouts of the remainder of the works. The disappearance of the original. The Wiesbaden judges reprimanded some of the appraisers and experts who appeared in court as witnesses. Their professional opinions seemed driven by their personal interests. According to his own testimony, one expert had declared every work sent to him to be genuine, contrary to knowledge he had obtained in his scientific examinations. The judgment stated that for some of the art historical experts, there was considerable doubt as to their seriousness and their professional methods. The estimation of the accused and their defense attorney that Patricia Rayling was an especially respectable art historical expert wasn't shared by the judges. "The original is disappearing," the expert Andrei Nakov said after the two were arrested. He had done research for lists of the works of Kazimir Malevich and Alexandra Exter, and he was himself a disputed figure among some experts. Daily, he gets emails with photos of alleged newly discovered works by these artists. The number of counterfeits appears to be unending. He deletes all the emails with photos of industrially produced suprematist compositions after the first glance. He tries to prevent the counterfeits from contaminating his joy in the real pictures. The Myth of Modigliani: How Classic Modernism is Systematically Counterfeited. Maria and Celine were the deciding factors, although nobody could have actually seen them yet. Nonetheless, somebody seemed to know 44 days before the official opening of the exhibition that their portraits would be seen starting in March 2017 in the Palazzo Ducale in Genoa, and that with all probability they were counterfeit. This unknown person sent the art collector and Modigliani connoisseur Carlo Pepi an image of Celine, an alleged Modigliani painting, one of his famous reclining nudes, which now command prices in the $100 million range at auction. This one looked strange to Pepi. The face was expressionless. The hair looked as if it was glued on. The left arm behind the head was anatomically incorrect, as was the angled left leg. "Counterfeit," the 72-year-old replied through his website regarding the painting Reclining Nude, Celine Howard. When the exhibition opened and the catalog was published, Pepi, a former businessman who ran a private museum in Crespina, near Pisa, also cast doubt on other paintings in the show. For example, another portrait of a woman, titled Maria, which, like Celine, had been exhibited previously. Soon thereafter, the French Modigliani expert Marc Restellini confirmed the suspicion and identified further counterfeits. The police seized 21 paintings after the exhibition closed, 3 days before its scheduled closing date. 6 months later, the restorer hired by the prosecutors to analyze the 21 paintings scientifically, Isabella Quattrocchi, proved that the signature of the painter was not authentic and that the pigments used were not those of Modigliani. "It's clumsy counterfeiting," she said. The Italian police investigated at least 6 suspects, among them Rudy Chiappini, the curator for the exhibition, Niccolò Sponzilli, the manager of Mondo Mostre Schiera, a company belonging to a well-known art book publisher that stages exhibitions, Massimo Vita Zelman, the president of Mondo Mostre Schiera, and Josef Gutmann, a Hungarian art dealer residing in New York. The traveling exhibition had already been to other locations before it came to Genoa. The state's attorney had not yet decided in fall 2019 if the proof was sufficient for an indictment for fraud and trafficking in counterfeit goods. If there's any classic modernist whose auction prices have rocketed to astronomical heights, it's the Italian Amadeo Modigliani, 1884 to 1920. Today there seems to be no upper limit on what his works can command at auction and in discreet private sales. For $170.4 million in November 2015, the Chinese collector Yo Yichen sold at auction Modigliani's nude New Couché, 1917-18. Another reclining nude, left side, went for $157.2 million at Sotheby's in May 2018. The Irish horse breeder John Magnier had paid $26.9 million for it 15 years earlier. Since then, the prices for Modigliani's paintings have climbed steadily. In November 2010, $68.9 million for the seated nude La Belle Romaine, and $19.1 million for a portrait of Modigliani's lover Jean Hébuterne. In June of the same year, one of only 26 surviving sandstone sculptures brought in 43.2 million euros. Another of those sculptures changed hands in May 2019 for $34.3 million. In 2014, the Swiss art dealer Yves Bouvier sold the nude Nu couché au coussin bleu, 1916, for $118 million to the Russian collector Dmitry Ribolovlev. The life of this Italian artist, like that of Vincent van Gogh, provides dealers an ideal myth with which to sell works on the art market. The debauched life of the Parisian bohemian artist in Montmartre, scandals about his nude pictures, inconstant relationships, alcohol and drugs, tragic illness with tuberculosis, an early death at the age of 35, and, because of that, a shortage of available works of quality. Whoever buys an expensive piece of art is also paying to be part of art history. The more dramatic the stories that can be told about the artist, the higher the prices that can be achieved with skillful marketing. Increasing prices, too, are always accompanied by the danger that the number of counterfeits will also increase. Being responsible for an exhibition of the works of Amadeo Modigliani has been a very risky proposition for many years. It's not just a question of the hordes of visitors that can be expected. Modigliani's strangely unreal portraits, which appear to reveal something about their subjects, draw crowds 100 years after the painter's early death. If the exhibit includes any of the large format nudes, which unleashed a scandal and nearly forced the show exhibiting them to close when they were shown in 1917 at the Galerie Berthevail in Paris, then there's no holding back the public, and visitor records wait to be broken. Modigliani's portraits have long had high recognition value. To be sure, they are psychologically powerful, but not polarizing, because their creator intended that viewers would recognize themselves in the work. Modigliani's pictures are straightforward, but complex and subtle enough not to be dismissed. They appeal to the majority without being dull or pandering. Modigliani has been in danger from an art historical perspective for a number of years. no other painter of classic modernism has been forged as often as Modigliani. And still there is no one authoritative catalogue raisonné of his authentic works. At least five lists of his works compete with each other. A sixth is underway, though the publication date has been postponed several times. In addition, an online project plans to publish a list of all known authentic works, and naturally each author claims to have compiled the definitive list. In the past few years, exhibitions have been shuttered, books and catalogues criticized as amateurish, paintings withdrawn from auction at the last minute, and substantial bribes offered. There have even been death threats related to allegations that this or that painting or drawing was, at best, a contemporaneous copy, not to use the nasty word forgery. Modigliani makes the art world tremble, and the art market as well, and not infrequently the two have entered into unwholesome alliances in the past. The only comparable phenomenon from the 20th century is with sculpture. Similar forgery scandals affected Auguste Rodin and Edgar Degas. Most especially, the Swiss sculptor Alberto Giacometti fell victim to counterfeiting. The Dutchman Robert Driessen admitted in 2015 before the district court in Stuttgart that he had forged 1,000 Giacometti sculptures. His accomplices, one of whom called himself Imperial Count von Falstein and asserted that he was a friend of the artist's brother Diego, claimed that the sculptures were secretly withheld from the public by Giacometti's heirs. They falsified certificates and even produced their own book with the title Diego's Revenge. The total damages of the fraud awarded by the court came to 4.75 million euros. It's important to study the continued mythification of Modigliani. He's hardly the only artist of the late 19th and early 20th century for whom the legend eclipses the historical reality and the working process such that biographically and artistically, truth and falsehood have long since merged. That the personal mythology of the artist was the marketing tool for classic modernism is described quite well by the art historian Robert Jensen. To market modernism, artists, their dealers, critics, and historians required above all to establish its historical legitimacy. The historiographic enterprise was as much a part of merchandising expressionism as the increasingly refined practices of art dealers to promote not only individual paintings, but whole careers, and to do so not only through conventional publicity, but through carefully constructed exhibitions and a mode of personal persuasions that variously appealed to the speculative and/or connoisseurship skills of the potential client, the amateur. To lift him from the flood of other offerings, it's necessary to market the artist either as an established historical figure or as a singular phenomenon of his time. The biographical and sociological representation of the artist increased in importance with the rise of the bourgeois art market, and in some cases got the upper hand. The legend of his life became as important as an artist's oeuvre in many instances, provided the legend was rich enough to separate him from the crowd of other art producers. Death as the beginning. There is a handful of artists about whom everybody can tell a story. Renoir is one of them. The artist who, in the last years of his work, used gauze to fasten the paintbrush to his crippled, arthritic hand. Or Monet, whose sight was failing so badly that he could barely finish the giant water lily pictures for the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris. Vincent van Gogh's supposedly slicing off his ear is among the artist anecdotes that, over the course of time, have penetrated the collective mythological consciousness. And the tragic early death of Modigliani, whose pregnant lover, Jeanne Hébuterne, killed herself one day later. It's no accident that the rise of this perennially popular legend coincides with the birth of the international art market. When the enlightened bourgeoisie can afford to decorate the walls of their own homes with paintings, the gallerists have to come up with arguments to convince the customers of the worth of whichever artists they happen to represent. That may be done by reference to the quality of the work offered for sale. Another tactic was made possible by the wildly proliferating number of art magazines at the end of the 19th century. They told stories to potential customers that allowed them to participate in the lives of artists. The more tragic, romantic, and mythological the stories of the artists were, the more significance their work seemed to gain. In art history, myths and legends usually begin with a piece of paper and a genuine recollection. Nothing much has changed about that in the last 100 years. While even then a good picture did not mirror reality, nor could it, at the beginning of the last century, reliable documentation was already occasionally necessary to lend the creator an aura of reality. Some artists might have long ago disappeared into the imaginary worlds that they painted, were it not for some extant proof of their existence today. There is a clear connection between these myths that glorify an artist, usually shortly after death, and mounting success in the art market, often coinciding with an influx of forgeries to satisfy the ever-increasing demand. To understand this connection, it's instructive to consider the parallels between Modigliani and the other great mythologized art personality of classic modernism, Vincent van Gogh. Both artists died young and under tragic circumstances. Modigliani, at 35 years old, of a tubercular inflammation of the brain. Van Gogh, at 37 years old, from self-inflicted gunshot wounds. Both painters led debauched lives, filled with drug consumption and visits to brothels. Both received only one piece of published criticism during their lifetimes. The Italian enjoyed only one single exhibition of his paintings in 1917 in the Paris Gallery Bertheil, at which he sold 2 drawings for a mere 30 francs each. Although more than the oft-cited single painting sold by Van Gogh, the number of paintings sold by Modigliani during his lifetime can still be counted on 2 hands. Both men are reputed to have eschewed success and material concerns. For both, artistic recognition and material success began shortly after death. The alleged failure of the 2 painters to achieve recognition during their lifetimes can be explained in retrospect because they were aesthetic loners. Of course, both Van Gogh and Modigliani had studied to be artists. Relatively quickly, both found their own style of painting, which, later on, had in both cases a high recognition value. Neither left behind acolytes who had continued in their style. That's why both artists' oeuvres are considered singular today. And finally, the glorification of the personalities and temperaments of both artists began soon after their deaths and thus included personal reminiscences that were authentic and not at all intended to further this goal. Émile Bernard, for instance, described the interment of his friend Vincent van Gogh in July 1890 in Auvers, near Paris. Bernard renders the scene so precisely and so movingly that 66 years later the Hollywood director Vincent Minnelli incorporated it almost unchanged into his script for the Van Gogh beatification Lust for Life, which engraved the Van Gogh myth in the post-war consciousness. At 3 o'clock the body was lifted up. His friends carried him to the hearse. Various people cried. Theodorus Van Gogh, who had worshipped his brother and who had always supported him in his battle for art and independence, never stopped sobbing. The sun was terribly hot outside. We climbed up the hill of Auvers and talked about him, about the strong forward push that he had given to art, about the magnificent projects that always occupied him, about the goodness that he gave to all of us. His last paintings were nailed to the walls of the room in which he lay at rest, forming a sort of holy glow around him and, because of the brilliance of the genius that radiated from them, made his death all the more painful for us artists. Atop the coffin lay a simple white cloth and countless flowers. Sunflowers, which he so loved, yellow dahlias, yellow flowers everywhere. That was his favorite color, the symbol of light, of which he dreamed in his heart and in his pictures. His easel, his folding chair, and his brush were placed on the floor in front of the casket. A similarly moving letter about the death of Modigliani serves as the founding document of his mythology. The Polish poet Leopold Zborowski, who was also Modigliani's dealer, wrote the letter to the artist's brother, Emanuele, on the day of the burial, January 31, 1920. The reason for the letter was profane. He had to convince Modigliani's relatives living in Italy that they needed to take care of his daughter, Jeanne, in the future. In fact, he unconsciously laid the cornerstone of a mythological Modigliani mausoleum, whose foundations remain sturdy today, despite 9 decades of art historical research. Today, Amade, my dearest friend, rests in the Père Lachaise Cemetery, covered in flowers as you and we both wanted. All the artistic youth of today came to give our dear friend and one of the most talented artists of our epoch a moving and triumphant funeral procession. 1 month ago, Amade urgently wanted to leave for Italy with his wife and child. He was only waiting for his wife to give birth. He wanted to leave the child that he expected with a nurse, who is also now tending his daughter Giovanna, Jeanne Modigliani. At this time, his health, always fragile, became disconcerting. My advice to enter a sanatorium in Switzerland was not heeded. I told him, "Your health is bad. Take care of yourself." And he acted as if I was the enemy and said, "Don't lecture me." He was a child of the stars, and reality didn't exist for him. Nonetheless, it didn't seem as if catastrophe lay around the corner. He had a good appetite. He went for walks and was in a good mood. He never complained about a hidden illness. 10 days before his death, he had to lie down in bed and suddenly felt sharp pains in his kidneys. The doctor who came diagnosed a kidney infection. Earlier, he refused to see a doctor at all. He suffered because of his kidneys, but said it would pass soon. The doctor came every day. I myself became sick on the 6th day of his illness, and my wife visited him in the morning. When she returned, I learned that Modigliani was spitting blood. We got the doctor who explained that he had to be taken to the hospital right away to stop the bleeding. He was brought to the hospital 2 days later unconscious. We did everything we could. His friends and I called in several doctors, but tuberculous meningitis had taken hold and had been eating away at him for a while, without a doctor discovering it. Modigliani was lost. 2 days later, Saturday, at 8:50 p.m., your brother died, without suffering and without consciousness. His last big wish was to leave Italy. He spoke of you and his parents often and at length. His unfortunate wife did not survive him. On the day after his death, at 4 in the morning, at the home of her parents, she jumped from the window on the 5th floor and was dead immediately. What tragedy, my dear Modigliani. I can hardly believe that I was just together with them, that we talked and laughed, and I said that I would visit them in Italy. His wonderful daughter, who is now 14 months old, is staying not far from Paris with the nurse in whose keeping Modigliani and his wife left her. 3 weeks before he died, as if he sensed his impending death, Modigliani got up at 7 in the morning. That was very unusual for him. He wanted to see his daughter. When he returned, he was very happy. In the meantime, I am the one taking care of her, but you are the only one who can replace her parents. My wife and I would gladly take her as our daughter, but Amade always expressed the wish that she would grow up with his family in Italy. Do not be concerned about the little one. I will see her in a few days with my wife. She is, in any case, in very good health and is starting to walk. A small committee has been founded as an homage to Modigliani, to collect pictures by various artists and sell them for the benefit of his daughter. That should result in between 25,000 francs and 30,000 francs, which you can accept on behalf of the little one, because it is a tribute by the painters to her father. Very truly yours, Leopold Zborowski, 3 Rue Joseph Barat, Paris 6. From this material, those myths are made that are needed by the international art market in order to sell the artist's work. There weren't yet any photo magazines in which intimate, at-home stories about the star artist nesting in his atelier might appear, nor were there widely publicized auctions about whose record prices one might report. nor was there television or the internet through which news of the fresh star in the art heavens could spread to customers across the world with the speed of light. The professional marketing services used by Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons today were in the past undertaken by relatives and friends of the artist. The PR that was necessary even then to lift a single artist out of the crowd and make him marketable. A tragic life, ended early, wasn't the worst sales pitch by any means.